Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue were joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Tuesday, June 15th, Alan and Joe were joined by investigative journalist New Albany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, co-host city director of operations Teresa Bourgeois, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
What does the shift in Israel mean for Joe Biden? According to the New York Times, the departure of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister is a relief for Democrats, but Iran and the Palestinians could test Mr. Biden's relations with a fragile new Israeli government. President Biden waited more than 3 weeks after his inauguration to place his first call to Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister at the time. It took Mr. Biden less than 3 hours after the swearing-in on Sunday of Mr. Netanyahu's successor, Naftali Bennett, to phone with what the White House called his warm congratulations. Mr. Bennett responded in kind, and on Monday, his centrist partner in the awkward coalition assembled to oust Mr. Netanyahu went even further, blaming Mr. Netanyahu for poisoning Israel's relationship with Mr. Biden and the Democratic Party.
Well, Joe, here's the deal. Obviously, anything is better than what Biden had in Netanyahu, who was a fierce friend of President Trump, and we can tell from the body language and the signals that were going between the Israelis and the Americans that things were not good. Now, 3 hours later, things are better. But it's a very close thing because, as you know, the parliament voted by a single vote to oust Netanyahu, basically. And there is going to be an awful lot of problems. There will be an awful lot of problems because these people are all from different parts of the Israeli body politic who are in control right now. Netanyahu is basically saying it won't last and I'm not going to help it last. The Americans are saying we'll do whatever we can, I think, to make it last and to make this work. And so I think the relationship that we are seeing developing between Biden and the new group is a positive sign, at least for Biden.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, it's clear the U.S. would like to cool things down a little bit in its relationships with a lot of different foreign countries. And it was a difficult one with Israel, especially because of the recent breakout of violence there. There were differing views across the Democratic Party and across the U.S. But now you have a coalition kind of government, and what that could mean, according to some analysts, is they really won't change anything. It'll be sort of a interim kind of thing until one party gets a clear majority. And now it's a power sharing arrangement. And that works well for the U.S. because they can have a stable relationship with Israel. And it's much better than, Netanyahu had bet on the Republicans. Remember back in 2015, he came at the invitation of the House of Representatives when John Boehner was there and spoke to them and tried to rally their opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. Went right around the Obama White House to do that. And that was insulting and infuriated Obama. And then the embracing by Trump of Netanyahu, I think it's backfired on him. I think Israel will be happier with the relationship it has with Washington. They don't have to pick sides. And then so stability, I think, is the message they're trying to get across.
Rosemary Armeo.
Well, this is an extremely unstable and precarious administration in Israel right now. And Joe Biden can help with that, possibly. I'm not quite sure how, because the interests of the United States and Israel remain largely the same, supporting the Netanyahu policies. settlement, for example, is supported by all kinds of powerful people in this country. And the evangelicals in this country continue to support the Israeli policies of Netanyahu. So he's limited by that, and it helps the Republicans when if he tries to change, he's going to get a backlash. I think the only thing that can really help, that will knock out Netanyahu as a power player in Israel, is if his legal problems increase. With now that he's out of office, he has no immunity, and he faces serious charges, the sort that I hope will be brought someday against President Trump. And if he goes to trial to face them, that could remove him from the political stage. He hasn't just signaled by body language. He has said outright that he believes he was fraudulently deprived of power and will fight the
I've heard that before.
Yes. The parallels between Trump and Netanyahu are absolutely shocking. They use the same techniques. And so the same dangers of a divided country, of a weak new administration, and of a powerful ex-president who's trying to undermine the administration remains. I like that Biden was so quick to signal his approval of the new guy. But again, American influence in Israel and in the Middle East in general is far reduced from what it was before 2016.
Teresa.
Obviously, this coalition is better for Biden, but it is a very delicate coalition at best, held only together by their joint opposition to Netanyahu. And so one of the things that I'm curious about but don't really have a handle on is, what are the other countries around the world? What are the forces at play? Who has the interest in helping hold this coalition together? And who has the interest in joining with Netanyahu to tear it apart? And so where will the help come for Biden to hold it together? Mm-hmm. Because it is, such a strategic and important place. Obviously a very special friend of the U.S., but important globally. And I think the whether or not it holds together depends on the global forces of U.S. and beyond to make it so. And I really don't have a handle on that, but I think that's one of the fundamental questions.
Mm-hmm. Alan, when you look at this of Biden obviously having, he's the president, so he has a lot of problems here and abroad, but where do you think this stacks up in the rank of things?
Well, I think it's important. Let's remember the Israelis have bombs. we are at a point now in our political development around the international world where if you have an A-bomb, it's different than if you don't have one. Do I think, considering the politics of the United States, the internal politics, that there is going to be any kind of fundamental change in the way the U.S. and Israel react to each other? I do not. And I do not for a lot of reasons. But I'm pretty sure that this is good news for Biden, as I said. And he's going to do everything he can to grow it. And the Israeli people now have to see whether they will be safe or as safe as they were perceived to be before. So I think, I think things have changed, all right. But still, Netanyahu becomes the big issue that we will have to see whether or not he's able to break into this coalition. He only won it by one vote. He only lost it by one vote.
Teresa?
Alan, I agree with you on the issue of the bomb, but what about the issue of oil? Does the as we move toward a cleaner economy in the U.S. and globally, and the pressures and the demands for oil shift and reduce, then how does that change what's happening in the Middle East? How does that change the whole dynamics of the Middle East if there's far less? Because, underlying a lot of these conflicts, there's cultural conflicts, but much of it from external forces is for the demand for the oil. And as the demand for the oil lessens and shifts to other things, how does that change the dynamics in the region, do you think?
I don't have a sense of what the difference is because of oil. U.S. now has more oil than it needs because of the sand shale and all the rest. The politics of the world based on oil have changed significantly, no question about it, and you have a good point there. But I don't know what it means.
Rosemary?
Well, I think that oil is going to be a major factor in the world economy for many years yet to come. Yeah, the shift has begun, but it's mostly just theoretical at this point. China still needs and wants it. So does India. So does the United States, for that matter. And so I also would not discount the role of Putin and the Soviet Union in the Middle East. He has an oil-based economy as well, so what does he want? He has an interest in playing up to Israel, and that changes his relationship with the Arab countries. He's also doing a major trade in grain and wheat in the Middle East. That used to be the United States' role. We have declined. France has a growing diplomatic role in the Middle East, as the U.S. under Trump gave that away. It seems like everybody is in a different position. They're weakened slightly. But Netanyahu wants to get back to where he was just the day before yesterday, and keeping him out is key to any kind of change in the Middle East. For the first time in this new coalition, Arab Israelis are involved in the government. So that's another thing to be watched. I've not seen a lot written about it. They are not very strong, but they never before even had a voice at all. That'll be interesting to watch.
Absolutely.
And that plays into the oil part of this as well.
Right, right.
Theresa?
And what of the Palestinians in all of this? I mean, it's been a very difficult time for them, particularly under Netanyahu. And so what happens to the Palestinians?
I think there's hope for the Palestinians for the first time, because it was really the horrible violence against them, the outsized response of the Israelis to recent provocations that provoked the attack that I did not see coming, really, against Netanyahu. I'm surprised he got knocked out. So and there's an increasing Israeli awareness of how unfairly they have been treated. So I see hope that maybe we'll go back to talking about a two-party state, although the Palestinians themselves have given up on that. What they want is autonomy and a one state under Israel. So with them involved in the government, there's hope for that. I think the humanitarian crisis in Gaza has won an increasing appeal both in Israel and outside that this should not be happening. And the Biden administration has shown a willingness to roll back some of the pressure that Jared Kushner and Trump put on these Palestinians. Their idea was to press them so hard that they would come to the table and negotiate. That did not work. That was a dismal failure. And people are truly, truly suffering. And I think everybody has a hand in wanting to end that. So I see some hope for them for the first time in a long while.
I was just wondering what Rosemary thought about Netanyahu, and was the violence, the most recent horrific violence, really instigated by him in his last-ditch effort to hold on to control, and then it backfired.
We keep on talking about this all.
Yes,
I'm fascinated by this subject.
I totally believe it was instigated. He waited until Ramadan, and then armed people went into the mosque in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, and pushed people out, pushed Muslims out. And then he tried to clear out a long-settled Arab neighborhood in East Jerusalem as well. So those were deliberate provocations. Hamas responded in a way, of course, I don't condone it, but I do think it was provoked. And he then responded, Netanyahu then responded with incredible it was just way, way oversized reaction with bombs that killed people, and all the time portraying himself as a victim. It's a pattern that we've seen before, and I think that he thought this would, again, make people feel like, oh, we have to be saved from the evil Palestinians. And instead, I was surprised. I had not predicted this. I thought he would get away with it. Instead, there was such revulsion at the violence that this unlikely and unusual coalition has come together and actually ousted him, at least for now. But there's always this little asterisk on whenever anybody writes or talks about it, that it's such a fragile alliance with nothing except dislike for the way Netanyahu was governing, that can it hold is the question.
Well,
this is a country that's under incredible and never-ceasing tension.
It seemed to me to be a hopeful sign that it was a rejection of him was part of it seemed to me a rejection of that, taking that kind of action, which I thought was a really hopeful, a glimmer of hope, a delicate, definitely a delicate coalition, but a glimmer of hope.
Anyone else on that? All right, so let's go to this story from the Washington Post. So the lobbyist brother of a top Biden advisor poses challenge to president's ethics promises. So let's find out more about this. Jeff and Steve Ricchetti, yes?
Steve Ricchetti, yeah.
When President Biden flew to Detroit last month to highlight his infrastructure plans for a new network of electric car charging stations, a White House official announced on Air Force One that senior counselor Steve Ricchetti had stayed behind to negotiate the bill with Republicans. Left unmentioned was that Ricchetti's brother, Jeff, was also working on the infrastructure bill as a lobbyist for General Motors, hired to push funding for charging stations in the House, in the Senate, and at the Commerce Department, according to federal documents. The separate efforts by one of Biden's most influential advisors and his brother, with whom he partnered in a lobbying firm until 2012, had been popping up for weeks on the radar of White House ethics lawyers who are charged with fulfilling Biden's promise to, quote, restore ethics in government. They required that Steve Ricchetti recuse himself from involvement with particular matters for four companies that paid his brother to lobby Biden, Biden's executive office: pharmaceutical companies GlaxoSmithKline, Vaxart, and Horizon Therapeutics, as well as TC Energy, the company that oversaw the now-canceled Keystone XL pipeline project, according to a White House official briefed on the arrangement. But under White House ethics guidance, Jeff Ricchetti's work with GM did not trigger a recusal for his brother because his lobbying targeted a cabinet agency and not the executive office of the president, and because the issue of electric charging stations applied broadly to the car industry and was not considered a matter specific to the company. That, according to a White House official. All right, Alan, what do we make of this?
Well, we see it in New York State. We see connections in the at the federal level. It goes on all the time. It has to do with money. It has to do with power. It has to do with who knows who and whether a president, for example, in this case, has relationships with some of the people who are in question. I don't know. I mean, you know, if I do remember my brother Lewis having a conversation with George Pataki, and Pataki said, "I like you, Lewis. Your brother, not so much." So, so what I'm saying is, there are all these interlocking things that go on all the time, based on money, based on politics, based on who supported who during this thing, and that ain't going to change in the near future.
Well, using your you use this phrase often, Alan, but you know, if it just seems that and now I forgot the phrase went completely out of my head. How good is that? But that
get a grip, Joe.
Thank you. that two wrongs don't make a right. And so my question is, but you look at this, Rosemary, and you see this infraction and you think to yourself, well, compared to what was going on in the Trump administration, this is just quaint.
I had to read the story two times
to
figure out what exactly the offense was.
Like, what was so horrible?
Yeah, and you compare that to Jared Kushner and Ivanka and Kellyanne. Oh, remember these names? I just had a throwback to the past. And outstanding, glaring, horrible ethical violations, and saying, why are we even bothering with this? However, I don't like that whataboutism when Republicans do it to me, and so I'm not going to do it to them. Joe Biden said he's going to clear up government. That's then his responsibility. And he needs to act on this. He needs to get that guy out of there and apologize.
Because he's
seriously
playing,
folks.
Okay, but let me just ask this question, and then I want to hear what you have to say on this. But he's playing by his rules, right? He set the rules on this of the ethics,
right?
Of what had to go through in the ethics. So we're playing by the rules that the administration set for themselves. Teresa, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, I think I'm the one that interrupts. Sorry, but I had to read and reread this and try to see, well, because I worked with Steve Ricchetti many, many years ago. Like, what is so bad about this? Because if you're in politics or policymaking, you might have family members who are in policymaking, either at the national level, state level.
Right.
And so, and there is always going to be overlap. What there needs to be is transparency. So I think as long as you're at the table and everybody knows the transparency, and you're not, if you're doing a specific deal, a special favor for your brother or your spouse or whatever, but to be operating in the same industry or field as a brother or cousin, whatever. I mean, I think of Secretary Chao, Secretary of Transportation, right? She was a Secretary of Transportation, and her family owned a shipping company. I mean, was that a problem that her family...
And her husband was Mitch McConnell.
You forgot that.
Or on the Democratic side, you know, the Podestas, the Podesta brothers,
sure.
right?
The Emanuels.
John, the Emanuels.
That's
Emanuel
right.
in healthcare. You know, Rahm Emanuel's working in the White House, and Zeke Emanuel is a healthcare expert, and they getting advice on the shape of the healthcare bill, but family members have similar overlapping interests on the Republican and Democratic side all the time. Maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems to me that there's trying to, you know, it's sort of reaching for, can we find an ethical violation? And this one seems to me to be overreach, unless I'm missing something.
I want to take the Rosemary point of view here, and that is that the press has to do their jobs, and they have to point it out, because you can't say...
But what's the it that they're pointing out, Alan?
What is the it here? You point out the relationship.
Did they?
You point out that there is a relationship.
And was there an ethics violation?
You don't even have to prove it. But you point out that there is a relationship, the press does its job, and people may raise an eyebrow or not.
But
you know, when people use terms like everybody knows, no, everybody doesn't know nothing.
By the fact that they went to the ethics committee on the other matters, they're obviously focused on transparency. So he goes to the ethics committee, they give him a review, they say you can do this, you can't do that. So obviously there was a proactive transparency process here, that some things they said yes to, other things that they said no to. And right. it's not that he was trying to, there was no evidence in this story that he was trying to hide something.
Right.
There was evidence in this story that he went to the ethics committee, it went through an ethics review and they made a determination. So why isn't that a positive thing? Why does that create a stink around Steve Ricchetti?
Because there's such a fine distinction between what was okay and what is not.
But there's also an issue of appearance of conflict of interest. And when people see what looks like a conflict, and you can parse it all out and say that this was done by the book, transparently, ethically, because we set up the ethic rules and it didn't violate any of those ethics rules. Mm-hmm. You can say all that, but if it appears that there's a lobbyist pushing for something that the administration is considering doing, and the two key people are brothers, there's an appearance of a conflict of interest, and that leaves a little bit of cynicism.
But you have the Secretary of Energy saying we need to have more charging stations. I mean, it's the policy of the administration. It's not like it's running counter.
I know, but he's carrying on the campaign in private industry. The brother is, while the administration person is pushing it on the government side. I mean, they're pushing in the same direction. I understand
But he's pushing the Biden policy agenda.
Isn't it fun when the calm people get kerfuffled?
Wow, Alan and I are sitting here. Alan, you feel left out?
I'm sorry, Alan.
I completely understand what you're saying, but don't you see a risk when you have these kinds of relationships and between, you know, people in the industry lobbying and people in government lobbying, even for the same thing, it's a appearance of a conflict of interest.
And to that point, I'm not saying this is important. However, Fox News has been making this an issue since March.
Of course.
And
you give them ammunition.
The headline on their site is Biden White House powered by family connections. I'm sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, I want to go back to another place I was and say that, and Mike knows this better than anyone, they set up all of these commissions. So you go to the commission and you get, and they lay hands on you and they say, yes, good, that's fine, you can do it. Nobody knows about that. And that's why I was making the point, what I consider to be the Rosemarian point, about how important it is that the press is out there and points this out.
Yes.
Because Andrew may have, may have to go to a committee, but he set them all up. He named the majority of the people on the commissions. If you follow what they do in terms of ethics, you're going to find out, I wonder why they're always with Andrew.
Here's one other thing that goes into this conversation. Biden has taken it on himself from the very first days that he went into power to clear up, to restore faith in government, to undo Trump's threatening of all the rules and regulations. And that means he has to be particularly careful. It does him no harm, since his policies are being pushed anyway to remove this guy. And it does a lot of good to say, yes, you're right. Yeah. We made a wrong ruling here. We're going to remove him.
Steve Ricchetti is a terrific public servant. He's brilliant. But he's not done anything wrong.
It doesn't matter. What I'm saying is it does not matter. Appearance.
It undermines people's confidence that this is being done above board and that it's not.
But only because Fox News has created this perception about Steve Ricchetti for months, that there's no there. And so do you allow Fox News to drive this guy out, a perfectly good lifelong public servant?
You're not driving him out. You're removing him from consideration
of this one issue. You're moving him
somewhere else.
Yeah, moving him.
It's not a big deal.
The issue is electric charging stations, which is the policy of the Biden administration. I can see if he was trying to push some private special deal that ran counter to overall agenda of the Biden administration. But he's where does it stop? Because he's advocating for the Biden policies that
you
his
have
brother
a point
happens
of where
to
it
agree
stops,
with.
But not here.
But where
Teresa.
Does it stop?
Not here. Not here. This is not worth it. He may not get charging stations. If he's really going for a bipartisan bill, he may not get the charging station. So he gains by
but so
saying,
does the administration. He's not advocating for his brother's special position. He is advocating for the Biden administration's position about moving
So you don't see a risk that people will think the opposite that
I think this is putting a fake stink on Steve Ricchetti because Fox News is looking
but all over the place, people who are completely ethical are barred from relation. Two lawyers in the same law firm, they can't represent two different clients who are opposing each other.
Right.
Or, former law partners, a judge and a lawyer, have a case and they can't go before their former partner. Not because that it's going to be wrong, but because they don't even want the opportunity to be you lobbying on behalf of the interests of your brother,
so
and getting something out of it.
So you're saying that one of the key people in the policy
I'm
people
saying
of the
differently.
Biden administration
I'm saying differently that there's other good people. Yes.
But he can't advocate for electric power stations because his brother works on it. All right, we're probably boring everybody.
Go ahead.
How many people in your family? How many brothers and sisters?
There's five of us.
There's five of you.
Yeah.
Now, and there are others where, Rosemary, how many in yours?
Five sisters.
So five sisters. So if any of them is a lobbyist, if any of them, the point is the more people in your family, the more at danger you
the
are.
The rating, yeah.
In terms of the tenor of this conversation.
Well, so if I worked, my brother's an energy expert, if I worked in the White House, then I couldn't discuss energy issues because my brother's an energy expert? My other brother's
a forestry. If he was lobbying for the very same thing, I think it would look like you're working together, even though I understand everything you said, but you do in government try to set a standard that avoids even an appearance of a conflict of interest so people have faith in the process.
Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, June 15th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel of the Week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, June 17th, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Albany City Chief Auditor Dorcia Pleers, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius Kelly, and Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman Ira Fussfeld.
So we talk about inflation, and the Fed estimates inflation will grow faster than projected just 3 months ago and moves up expectations for a rate hike. Latest projections come as central bank wrestles with when to put back to pull back, on its support for financial markets. The Federal Reserve expects inflation will climb to 3.4% this year, higher than the central bank's previous forecast, while also projecting for the first time that there could be two interest rate hikes in 2023. The predictions released Wednesday after the Fed's two-day policy meeting depict a delicate but mostly upbeat narrative of where central bankers think the economy is headed, as well as a serious revamp of predictions from just 3 months earlier. In March, the Fed predicted inflation would be 2.4% for this year. Moreover, earlier Fed estimates did not project an initial interest rate hike until 2024. Alan.
I just remember that when Roselle and I bought our first house, 50 years ago in Alford, Massachusetts, and we had to beg for a mortgage, and the mortgage rate was 13%. 13%, it would seem like not doable. They would hang people for that. So, that doesn't happen anymore. Now, look, we've been having it pretty good, and there are going to be interest raises, no question in my mind, and it will bring out the appropriate amount of yelling, screaming, and anger from the critics of the Democratic administration.
Here is the New York Times take on this. Their simple way of understanding the recent rise in inflation. As the pandemic is receding in the U.S. That's there, by the way, their qualifier, that it's the simple way of explaining this. As the pandemic is receding in the U.S., demand for goods and services is rebounding more quickly than the supply of those same goods and services. And when demand outpaces supply, prices rise. The demand part of the story is fairly obvious. More Americans are shopping in stores, eating in restaurants, and planning vacations. They are spending some of the savings that they accumulated during the pandemic, including money from the government stimulus checks. Supply, however, is not back. The pandemic disrupted supply chains for many items, including computer chips, paint, lumber, and sneakers. It also disrupted work habits, and not everyone can or wants to return immediately to their old jobs. What did they just say this morning?
Yeah.
40% of people that are interested in resigning from the jobs they currently have.
Yeah.
I say to you, Alan, I'm not one of them. Just wanted you to know that. Okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm positive. Please don't resign.
On that note, I've actually had a number of conversations with former students that graduated from Siena or students that are on the job market now. And the conversations I have are so interesting. They're talking about, if this position that I have is not satisfying me, I will look for a new position. I don't really feel strongly about going back to the office and interacting with my same old colleagues because, at a distance they were fine, but I really don't want to spend time
with
them.
Who's speaking now? You or the students?
My students. My former students and my students. This is the kind of commentary I get. So a lot of movement and bounciness is in the market because they are looking for more fulfilling and meaningful positions. That is a marked change from the past. So they are willing to wait a little longer. They're willing to jump around more. Some of the former students I've had are sort of saying, I used to think I have to stick with the job for a year before I jump. No, 2 months of experience here, and it's not the environment I see myself in, or I don't really like my boss or coworker. I'm going to move on. So that's what I call bounciness.
But Vera, right now, anybody could get jobs. There isn't a store in Great Barrington that doesn't have a help wanted.
That's not a job that they want.
Well,
that's what I mean.
No, that's a job that somebody wants.
Maybe that is a job that somebody wants but cannot take because they have other responsibilities. There are children in the house that need to be taken care of, and the federal government does not support.
What, they didn't have children in the house before?
But they might not have schools open, kindergartens open, the same support. And you know what? That's what I mean that Europeans are doing. They're providing assistance to families and single moms that need help with children. They're providing payments so that the kindergarten fees or the babysitting fees aren't so high. So there's a huge discrepancy between what people need to get back into the workforce and what the reality looks like. I'm sorry, just because I see a sign in stores that they want somebody doesn't mean the pay is good, doesn't mean they have health insurance, doesn't mean that's the kind of job people want or can take because of the hours. These are very serious considerations, and we have to look at reorganizing the economic market.
But I have a question for you. Far be it from me to critique.
Dorsey, go ahead.
Yeah, far be it from me to critique what you've just said, but didn't people have children before the panic? Didn't people have children at home? I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, but not schools closed. And
now they're open.
Not all. Nope.
Yeah, well, they're going to open. Are you going to give us the same line? It's a good line, of course, that we ought to be doing more for families and everything. Mm-hmm. Are you going to say that after the schools are all open? Are you going to still say, well, you know, they're not good enough jobs and all the rest?
So I'm going to call on Dorsey to see what Dorsey has to say on that. Because I have an opinion on that.
Just like
I articulated
I'm
it. I'm going to call on Dorsey to see what you have to say on that.
Dorsey goes to work.
Yes, she does.
I'm thankful and blessed to have a job and a career, actually, and a job that I love. But what I'll say, Vera, is that I think that element was there pre-COVID when it comes to the generation, the new generation in terms of, you know, I remember growing up, my mother would always say, and I grew up in D.C., get you a good government job. That was what she was told. You get you a good government job, you stay in the government, and you work it, and you retire. And that, you know, gone are the days where people are graduating from college and saying, I'm looking for a good government. And some people still are. But, mm-hmm. you know, this notion that the best thing since sliced bread is a good government mm-hmm. job, and I'm going to stay in for my pension. And so we saw pre-COVID that people tend to stay in jobs 3 years and then they're off to the next. I think that this pandemic has, you know, really accelerated this thought that, you know what, I can find a job and I don't have to live in the same place where the headquarters is located. I could actually be flexible and find a job that meets my needs. I can work from home. And so I think in addition to this different mindset about what it means to work, and also the type of work that I want to do, there are employers now who understand they can be more nimble and offer 100% remote positions to people anywhere in the country. I think the other piece of the pandemic that some people overlook is this notion that people have a different mindset of what it means to give up their time and willing to, I'm not going to stress out if I don't have to. I want to find a work environment in which there's flexibility, I'm not stressed, my values closely align with the employer's values, and I'm doing mission-driven work. And I've been hearing a lot of my own colleagues and peers who have been saying that. And the last point on this topic I'll make is that for my peers and colleagues of color, very interesting conversation playing out, you know, in the wake of George Floyd and all of the racial unrest, many have been saying, and as people are increasing the amount of diversity and inclusion and equity staff that they have on as part of their workforce, but many of my colleagues and friends of color are saying, you know what, I am interested in starting my own because right. I don't want to be in work environments in which I'm not valued. I am the only one, and I have to speak on all issues of race. It's stressful. It's traumatizing. And so I'm just going to – we're in a market where I can create my own. And so I think that's a very interesting dynamic to this the situation that we're in now. Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. I see that as well in terms of entrepreneurship is up. It really matters to find a position that where the values match up. I have a number of students of color who are going back for graduate degrees. that are, you know, they're now thinking this is the time. They're also tremendously heated discussions about how much debt people want to take on for the future. These are very interesting factors that might just completely reshape how we live and how we do business and how employers treat their employees.
Do your students have to come back to class?
Oh, yes. In the fall, we're completely in person.
And your professors have to come back to
class? Yes. Everybody has to be vaccinated. Employees, faculty, students.
Vera Icarius-Kelly on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, June 17th. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, after this. Final segment of this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok welcomed former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
Senate Republicans vowed Thursday to block voting legislation from advancing later this month, rejecting a key Democratic senator's compromise offer that adopted some GOP ideas in a bid to break partisan gridlock on the issue. The pledge from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell all but guarantees that Republicans will filibuster a sweeping voting bill the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is sending to the floor on Tuesday. Parts of the bill are meant to overrule provisions contained in a host of GOP-passed state laws that have placed restrictions on early voting, mail-in voting, ballot drop boxes, and other policies that make it easier to cast a ballot in response to former President Donald Trump's false claims of a stolen 2020 presidential election. McConnell said, I've taken a look at all the new state laws. None of them are designed to suppress the vote. There is no rational basis for the federal government to take over all of American elections. Meanwhile, what are the Democrats up to in this? And this comes to what is being referred to as the Magic 50 vote. Democrats and progressive activists who have been working for months on a sweeping voting rights bill quickly embraced on Thursday a new, far narrower plan suddenly put forward by Senator Joe Manchin, their party's sole holdout on the issue. Their decision to do so did nothing to improve the chances that the legislation could get through the Senate, but it reflected another significant goal for Democrats, uniting the party around what it has billed as its highest priority and showing that were it not for Republican opposition in the filibuster, the election's overhaul would become law. In other words, it's easier then to blame it on the Republicans. Much to the growing consternation of Senate Republicans, the alternative ideas put forward by Mr. Manchin, a centrist from West Virginia, and the only Democrat who has refused to support what is known as S1, quickly gained traction with progressive Democrats and activists, most notably Stacey Abrams, the voting rights champion in the state of Georgia. A lot there. Alan, let's unpack.
Well, I got to confess that nothing scares me more than what the Republicans are doing here. They are eschewing their responsibilities as United States citizens and basically, fundamentally saying to Donald Trump and his group, go ahead and steal the election. Go ahead and steal these elections. It's beyond incomprehensible because, they really have brought shame to the concept of citizenship and staying with the proper perspective. So they are doing that. Now, Manchin is an interesting guy. I don't know what he's up to. Of course, we always know that we all know he comes from West Virginia. There, it's a Republican state. He wants to keep their votes. He wants to be a sort of Republican. But he's been saying no, 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 no. Now, at the last minute, he says, I have a compromise plan which everybody should go for. And McConnell stands up and says, no, absolutely not. No, because he knows, and all Republicans of his stripe know, that they're about to lose in the great political wars, and that they have to steal the election. And they're trying their best. It's the most disgusting thing I've seen in my time. They have to steal the election by loading it and doing all the things that Trump keeps saying everybody else is trying to steal it. No, they're trying to steal it, and we know it, and it's obvious, and they're going to not stop because they understand that they're going to lose in the great elections that will be coming if they don't load the elections, and that's what they're doing.
Because he is taking copious notes, let's go to Aaron Pacitti.
Something that I think we've discussed as a panel for quite some time is the whole bipartisan farce that, you know, it's like, well, we just have to reach across the aisle, and Republicans have no interest in
any of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, Republicans are trying to preserve the really hard and extremely impressive work they've been doing over the past 40 years to rig the voting system with gerrymandering, with relaxed regulations on campaign finance. So, yeah, Republicans are just trying to take this one step further, and it's moving in an anti-democratic way, and that is to literally prevent people from voting.
They have to, right?
Because, of course they have to.
Because they know they're on the losing side, and unless they steal it, they can't have it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the survival of the Republican Party is based on keeping a lot of these, policies in place, and if you start chiseling away at that, they start losing their majority and power. And so this is a survival tactic for the Republicans.
Judith.
Well, this is incredibly worrisome. I'm very interested in gerrymandering, and that's a situation where Democrats and Republicans both very much abuse the system. I mean, you look at how some of these lines are drawn in New York, for instance, and it's just nuts. It's not, you know, county by county. It's, these squiggly lines to benefit a particular party. So disappointed in both parties on that. On other issues like early voting and having similar to mailboxes to drop off votes, I mean, it's pretty clear that the Democrats are trying to make it easier for everyone to vote. And there's no data that I've seen that says more Democrats vote in early voting than Election Day voting. And the Republicans are just putting up barricades, and it's really disturbing. This is such a game of inside baseball, though, where Schumer and others have made such a big deal of getting this compromised proposal from Manchin, but that doesn't get you over the finish line. That just gets you right. 50 votes. But with the filibuster, you need the 60 votes. And I think Schumer's decided, you know, this is the hill he's going to die on because he wants to be able to say the Republicans are the ones who blocked making it easier to vote. I just don't see that messaging moving a whole lot of people. So I think the Manchin proposal, you know, it's weak tea, but it's at least it's 15 days of early voting and a couple other reforms. That would have been the good, maybe final compromise, not your opening volley. So it's all troubling. And I do, after everyone speaks, I do want to come back and talk about a very important voter suppression issue, which is happening right in our own backyard in Rensselaer County. This is not just about Washington. This is not just about Georgia and Florida, but voting suppression is rampant in many communities.
We get to David Soares.
Well, first and foremost, I think we have to understand that the Republican Party, they're never going to win as far as the battle of ideas. They're not going to increase membership in their parties, in their party, as long as they continue to veer to the right. And they seem very comfortable not only veering to the right, but continuing to move further to the right. The elected officials from that party seemed more obsessed with saying outrageous things, conducting themselves in outrageous manners, all for the purpose of self-promotion and all for the purposes of getting those small donor dollars that seemed to be working. If you look at just Marjorie Taylor Greene, that is the example of what your typical Republican representative is right now. And there's an entire class of those individuals. Now, having said that, you're not going to win political campaigns by just continuing to act as like a fool, right? You need to deliver results for your constituents. She's not part of any committee right now in the House of Representatives. She has no voice and literally no ability to deliver anything to her constituents.
Yeah, but she gets elected.
But she gets elected because of the outrageous conduct and behavior. And I think that that's why the Republican state legislative bodies that we're seeing right now are so obsessed with changing the rules at the ballot box.
Absolutely.
Right? And for our listeners, I think we can't stress this enough. There are people who like to just watch the playoffs, right? And I consider like federal elections to be the bigger elections. That's like the playoffs, right? Those people who just want to watch the playoffs that don't involve themselves in the regular season, that's where the game really is at. The game right now is in local elections. It's in state elections. The state legislature controls all of the redistricting and all of the gerrymandering, right? So we have to do a much better job of communicating to the masses that we have to pay attention to these local state races to make sure that we end all of this. So it's not just waiting on Mr. Manchin, you know, to do what is the right thing, but it's actively working every year to make sure that our voices are being represented in local government. As for Joe Manchin, here's Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin reminds me of like the guys I was hanging out with in middle school, right? During the middle school dances, you know, George Michael's playing on the big speaker, Careless Whispers, right?
Yeah.
And
or Careless Whispers.
It's Careless Whispers. Okay. Guilty Feet ain't got no rhythm, man. Come on.
All right.
Right?
Gotcha.
It's like all of us are hanging out underneath the basketball rim, and there she is. You see her. And this dude's going to go ask her to dance. And he goes and asks her to dance. He gets rejected. And you have that long walk home back to the rest of us underneath the basketball rim, right?
Right.
Joe Manchin continues to court the Republican Party, right? He walks over. He wants someone to dance with. They keep saying him no. Mitch McConnell just said no. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. No. But Joe just keeps going out there and asking, you know, and getting rejected and having that long walk back.
You paint a picture.
It's experience, and I had a bad Jerry curl. It was my Jerry curl, man. It wasn't my lines. It was my Jerry curl back in the day that hurt my chances. But the point that I'm making is that there's at some point in time, even when Wham is on the radio, you just got to stay home and try to have a good time, right there with the rest of us that are not dancing with the girls. Okay, and so. What we have right now is the Democratic Party bargaining with itself because it cannot bargain with you. We're trying to hammer out deals for 50 because we're not going to get 60.
Well, McConnell's made it clear that it doesn't matter what the policy is. If a Democrat proposes it, it's just no. And he's got the entire rank and file in line. So I don't know why this is a mystery to anyone anymore. They are not Republicans are not interested in governing, right? They're not interested in discussing, negotiating over, and compromising on important pieces of legislation. It's just no, right? They're a party that's devoid of ideas, and as David pointed out, there's a lot of new candidates coming into the mix who are running on, you know, wedge cultural issues, right? There's no policy discussion. That's the modern Republican Party. It's, you know, rile up the base, have no legislation except for, you know, giant tax cuts for, you know, millionaires and billionaires, full stop. That's the modern Republican Party. And how do you negotiate with a party where that's their starting point? It's just not possible.
Transgender children in sports. That's it.
But what Manchin's doing, he comes from a very Republican state. So he has to appeal or at least provide window dressing so when he runs for re-election, he can say, see, I tried to be bipartisan. So it serves him well from his narrow political self-interest. Doesn't serve anybody else very
well. We mentioned
this. I don't know about that. Are you going to allow Manchin to lose his political office? You've got a 50-50 split in the Senate. If you're the Democratic Party, you've got to both protect him, and a few of them are allowed to go along and say, well, you know, we don't like this. He shouldn't be doing this. But they know full well that they can't desert Manchin. Now, as far as Manchin's concerned, I think he had a strategy going. Maybe I'm reading too much into this. But I think his strategy was, I'm going to say no to the Democrats, no to the Democrats, no to the Democrats. And then at the exact magical right moment, I'm going to say it's time for a little bit of a compromise and I'll get my way. Wrong.
Judith?
Well, I want to build on what David was talking about. I definitely don't want to talk about his middle school dance rejection, which he seems to
it's painful,
be hearing.
Judith. It's painful.
I know.
Painful.
You... still with you. I'm sorry. But David made another point about paying attention locally and not just in the World Series or the playoffs. So people should know that early voting is happening right now in New York State. We used to have a primary in September. It's now happening this Tuesday, June 22nd. And there's some very spirited primaries going on for the Democratic Party and also the Working Families Party, which the Republicans are trying to take over. I'm really interested in reforms in the voting area to make it easier for people to vote and different ways of voting. So at some point, we should talk about ranked choice voting in New York City, as is unfolding in the mayor's race.
Yeah.
So in that race also, early voting is happening. And the New York State Legislature decided a few years ago to make early voting a requirement across the state. Good thing, right? Well, in Rensselaer County, they set up early voting sites in the suburbs, but nothing in the city of Troy, mm-hmm. Nothing. So it took an act of the state legislature to say, you also have to have an early voting site in your most populous city. So the Rensselaer County Board of Elections then says, okay, we have to do that. They put the site as far away from downtown Troy as you could get, up the hill, not accessible to people with disabilities, people without cars. Very nice Armenian church, but good luck getting there if you live in downtown Troy. Recently, Attorney General Tish James sues the Rensselaer County right. Board of Elections, wins, and then at the 11th hour, the Board of Elections decides to appeal the decision. So the judge says there's no early voting site in downtown Troy, and the appeal will be heard 2 days after Tuesday's primary. The Board of Elections scrambles and says, oh, you can do absentee voting at the Board of Elections building in downtown Troy. But it's such a transparent effort not to make early voting available and easy for people in downtown Troy.
And no shame.
And who's who's making this decision? I learned that the election decisions are made the following way. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party both appoint election commissioners to your county board of elections.
Right.
And then they have to reach consensus or agreement. So in this case, you have both the Democratic commissioner and the Republican commissioner uniting in blocking early voting in downtown Troy. This is the very definition of voter suppression. And it's not just happening in Florida and Georgia, but it's happening right here in our own backyard.
Judith Henk on the Roundtable panel on Friday, June 18th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. Thank you for listening. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke.